Hello, everyone. My name is Hannah, and you're listening to Mystic and Murder, a paranormal, unexplained, and true crime podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be covering part two of Escape from Alcatraz, so if you haven't heard part one yet, you may want to listen to that one first. In part one, we discussed the 1937 escape of Theodore Cole and Ralph Rowe. They managed to escape on a foggy day and enter the bay, never to be seen again. It was concluded that they had drowned, but their bodies were never found, and rumors circulated that they might have been alive and well, living in South America. We left off talking about the infamous escape of 1962, where Frank Lee Morris, John Anglin, Clarence Anglin, and Alan West were, for the most part, prepped and ready to go. It had been a long 7 months of detailed planning. The plan was to escape at nighttime, shortly after counts were done. They would place dummy heads made from plaster, soap chips, concrete, and real human hair in their beds in order to fool the guards. Then, they would climb out of the hole in the back of their cell that they had dug out with spoon handles into the utility corridor that was sandwiched between cells. They would climb 3 stories up the pipes to the cell block roof. Once there, they would gather their life vests and raft that they had fashioned from more than 50 rubber raincoats, some of which were stolen, and others donated to the cause by prisoners who knew about their plan. After that, they were going to escape onto the cell house roof, climb down a pipe, and make a run for the bay. On June 11, 1962, Morris told the men that the ventilator was finally loose enough to push onto the roof, and tonight was the night. That night, after lights out, the men put their dummy heads in their beds, entered the utility corridor, and started climbing the pipes. There was one problem, though. West couldn't remove the vent grill from his hole. Remember, he wanted to leave it in place in case any maintenance had to be done to the utility corridor. He didn't want the hole to be seen. Turns out, he hadn't dug around it enough, and no matter what he did, he couldn't push through. Clarence had tried to help him remove it from the backside, but it wouldn't budge. According to West, Clarence left to go get help from the others, but never returned. Around 10:30 p.m., a loud noise from the rooftop let other prisoners know that they were on their way out. Here's a quote from James Whitey Bulger about that night. Quote, "I knew the men were on their way as I heard the cover of the ventilator shaft hit the roof and scattered the seagulls. It made a lot of noise when it hit, and the seagulls reacted. We picked up our beds and banged them on the floor as guys did in all the other cell blocks. It distracted the guards, and they focused on the racket we were creating. It was not uncommon as we would make this type of noise if the radio had too much static or if someone said something to upset the guys." End quote. Later that night, around 1:30 a.m., Alan West was finally able to remove the vent grill and make his way up to the roof. When he got there, Morris and the Anglin brothers were long gone. He had no choice but to return to his cell and go to sleep. Let's go back a few hours in time. Obviously, we don't know exactly what happened, but here's what's thought to have gone down. On the cell block roof, Clarence, John, and Frank had gathered everything they needed to make their escape. Around 10:30 p.m., they pushed the ventilator cover onto the roof, and the prisoners below heard a loud clang, followed by the sound of seagulls. Down below, prisoners began making a lot of noise, like picking up their beds and slamming them back down again, anything to help distract the guards from what was going on the roof. Now, I'm sure you remember me saying that Alcatraz was a maximum security prison, with a 1-to-3 guard-to-prisoner ratio and 5 watchtowers overlooking the island. But unfortunately, things at Alcatraz had become a little laxed. Out of the 5 guard towers, only 1 was manned that night. The guard towers were used mainly in the daytime to watch over prisoners as they worked in different buildings, but when the prisoners were supposed to be in their cell, there really wasn't a need for them to be manned, or so they thought. Once the men got onto the roof, they were able to run across to the north end by the kitchen and scale down a 50-foot pipe to the ground. Footprints show that they ran under the water tower, and to the side of the quartermaster building where they were out of sight of the guard tower. They somehow got over a barbed wire fence, climbed down a steep embankment, and jumped down from an 8-foot seawall onto the sharp rocks below. Then, they set up shop. Remember the concertina in Frank Morris's cell? It had multiple uses as far as their escape. He purchased the instrument on April 1st of 1962. Not only did he use the case to cover the hole in the wall of his cell, but he had actually modified the instrument to make it silent, and they used that to blow up the raft. Once the raft was inflated and the men had their life vests on, they got into the bay. What happened next is truly a mystery. The next morning, after the men were discovered missing, the manhunt began. Every nook and cranny on Alcatraz Island was searched, and an all-points bulletin was released. Police all over California, the surrounding states, the home states of the men, and their relatives were alerted and on the lookout. The initial search lasted for 10 days on land, air, and sea. Their bodies were never recovered, but they did find bits and pieces of evidence from the escape. The FBI reports show that in the days following the escape, several things were discovered. First off, they discovered the holes in the prisoners' cells, including the one in Alan West's cell. West was very cooperative with the investigators, and his failed escape attempt is one of the reasons we know so much about this escape. In the days following the escape, he provided a lot of insight, details about the escape, and even what the plan was once they were off the rock. He said that once they were in the water, the plan was to head north to Angel Island first, rest up a bit, and then cross the Raccoon Strait over to Marin. Once on the mainland, they would steal a car, steal some clothes, and drive to Mexico. Whether or not he was telling the truth, or if he told investigators something to throw them off from the actual plan, we'll never know for sure. There was some evidence that suggests that this might have been their actual plan, but we'll get into that in a bit. On June 12th, the day that they were discovered missing, quite a few things were found. On the cell block roof, they discovered a homemade paddle that had been left behind, the life vest that was intended for Alan West, a homemade periscope that they used to watch for guards, and a smaller raft, which allowed investigators to see the ingenuity behind the escape, as well as study how it was made. On the cell house roof, they found the cover of the vent. On the ground near the water tower, they found footprints. The distance between the prints indicated that the subject was running. In the days following the escape, a wooden paddle was recovered from the water that matched the one left behind on the cell block roof. It had been found floating on the northwest side of Angel Island on either the 12th or the 13th. The date is a bit unclear because I found multiple sources that had varying dates. On June 14th, a small, olive-colored, watertight bag fashioned from prison raincoats was found in a whirlpool 2 or 3 feet below the surface of the water. Inside, it contained close to 100 photographs of the England family and their friends. There were also several pages of paper with contact information, names, phone numbers, and addresses. Several of the photographs had personal inscriptions to Clarence on it, so it's thought that the bag was probably his. Finding this piece of evidence led the FBI to believe that the men didn't make it. This packet contained important resources that could be utilized after the escape, as well as the most important personal items that he owned, so the FBI thought that there was no way that he would leave this behind. Let's say it did belong to Clarence. Personally, I think if I were him, and I was in a life or death situation in the middle of a bay with strong currents and freezing temperatures, if a bag containing the most important things to me fell off the raft or out of my pocket, maybe I wouldn't have noticed until it was too late, or maybe I noticed, but I chose to keep going without it because perseverance of life is more important than material things, but who knows. On June 15th, a life vest was found floating near the north shore of San Francisco, and on June 22nd, a second life jacket was found about 50 yards east of Alcatraz Island. Again, this supported the FBI's theory that the men drowned, but who's to say that they didn't just throw their life jackets in the water once they reached shore? Or maybe if they left their life jackets on land, a high tide could have taken them back out to the bay. The 22nd was the last day of the big search, and it was officially concluded that the men likely drowned in the cold, shark-infested waters. According to the U.S. Coast Guard, the water ranged from 50 to 54 degrees that night. If they were trying to get to Angel Island, it would have been extremely difficult to reach because the tides and the currents would have taken them in the opposite direction. The FBI agent in charge, Don Eberle, stated that he believes they were taken by the current and swept out into the Pacific Ocean. Drowned bodies found and recovered along the California coast in the months following the escape were all examined, but none of them matched the descriptions of the missing men. Assuming they drowned, coroners in several surrounding counties said that it's not possible to know if and when the bodies would surface. There are so many factors involved, like temperature of water, bodily gases, interference from wildlife, and more that would really make it impossible to determine. The bodies of Frank Lee Morris, John Anglin, and Clarence Anglin were never recovered. Did they succumb to the cold temperatures? Were they swept into the Pacific? Were they attacked by man-eating sharks? Or did they make it? Despite the end of the search and the conclusion that Morris and the Anglin brothers had drowned, the investigation continued long after, and the FBI followed up on any leads they had. They used the list of contacts found in the olive bag to see if anyone had heard from the escapees, but those who knew the men said that they had not heard from them, and some contacts on the list claimed that they didn't even know any of them personally. So, that was a dead end. On August 8, 1962, an interesting report came in. Apparently, on July 17, 1962, a Norwegian freighter ship, the SS Nora Fjell, departed from Pier 38 in San Francisco Bay. It was heading to Canada. Around 6 p.m., the crew members saw something bobbing in the water about 20 miles northwest of the Golden Gate Bridge. With binoculars, they realized that it was a dead body. They said that it was floating face down with its arms and legs dangling in the water. The person was fully clothed in a denim outfit that appeared to match prison-issued clothing. Unfortunately, they were not able to retrieve the body, and they didn't have a transceiver that was able to operate on the frequencies used by the U.S., so there was no way of reporting the sighting. A formal report wasn't made until the ship returned to America that August. We know that the coroner said it was impossible to determine if and when a body would surface, but they did confirm that it was possible for a body to remain floating for 5 weeks following the incident. According to the FBI, no other person was reported missing or drowned who had been wearing clothing matching that description, so this sighting was extremely significant. The FBI was also on the lookout for any criminal activity following the escape. If they made it, these career criminals surely wouldn't be able to stay out of trouble, right? They would need money, civilian clothes, a car, things that would be noticed. According to the FBI, there was no reports of crime or stolen property or anything that suggested that they made it. Because of this, many would agree that they didn't make it, but there is some evidence to support that maybe, just maybe, they did. The day after the escape, the office of a San Francisco lawyer known to represent Alcatraz inmates received a phone call from a man claiming to be John Anglin. The lawyer was not in office that day, so the call was transferred to another attorney named Eugenia McGowan. The person claiming to be Anglin asked her to call the U.S. Marshal's office and set up a meeting. She asked what for, and the person basically said, "Don't ask questions, just do as I say." She told him that she wasn't going to set up a meeting unless she knew why. She recalls him saying, "You know who I am," and when she said that she didn't, he said, "Read the newspaper," and hung up. The FBI was alerted and they set up a phone tap, hoping that he would call back, but he never did. The call was dismissed as a prank. On June 18th, Warden Odin G. Blackwell received a postcard with a short message on it. It read, Haha, we made it. And it was signed by three people, Frank, John, and Clarence. This postcard was tested for fingerprints and handwriting was analyzed, but the results were inconclusive. When prisoners received mail, they had a specific address for the mail to be sent to. The address on the postcard did not match that address, so for this reason, and because the results came back as inconclusive, they also determined that this was a prank. An inmate named Clarence Carnes claimed that he received a postcard from the inmates a few months after the escape. It said, "Gone fishing," which were the prearranged code words to confirm their success. In the days, months, and years that followed, there were many reported sightings of the Englands and Morris. You might be asking, how is it possible? Well, there are many theories about how they could have survived and where they may have gone, and we're going to talk about them all right after this message from our sponsors. The first theory has a lot of questions left unanswered, but it's that they made it on their own. The swim from Alcatraz to the mainland really wasn't as impossible as it seemed. It would be extremely difficult, sure, but it can be done. I'm not sure what year it started, but there's an annual event called Escape from Alcatraz Triathlon, where a huge amount of people swim across the bay. Of course, there are lifeguards in the event that someone needs help, but this particular event doesn't even allow the contestants to wear wetsuits or swim aids of any kind. Aside from that annual event, there are many other events throughout the year where people swim from Alcatraz, like the Odyssey Alcatraz Swim, the Alcatraz Shark Fest Swim, and the non-competitive, monthly Alcatraz Crossing Swims. To me, this just goes to show that it is extremely possible to make it from Alcatraz to the mainland. Of course, Morris and the England brothers would have been doing it under much different circumstances. They were swimming, or floating on their raft, in the dead of night with a bunch of adrenaline and probably a fear of getting caught. The England brothers were known to be really good swimmers, but they had no knowledge of the tidal patterns or currents, though it's suspected that they may have taken note of the tides while out in the wreck yard. In fact, the wreck yard may have been used to their advantage in more ways than one. An inmate named Darwin Kuhn gave some insight as to how they got all the raincoats. He said that one day, John Anglin approached him and asked if he had a raincoat. He told Kuhn to wear it out to the wreck yard, take it off, and Anglin would wear it back in. Another well-known inmate, James Whitey Bulger, later told authorities that he had given Morris and the Anglins some advice in the wreck yard. Indirectly, that is. According to Bulger, he and Morris were both good friends with another inmate named Jack Twining. Morris and Bulger passed messages to each other through Twining because the two had never really spoken to each other before and they didn't want to raise any suspicion from the guards. Bulger recalled that Morris had asked him about the tides and equipment. Bulger had experience diving, so he had a lot of recommendations for them. Tips were passed on through Twining that they should shower fast, hop in, and hop out. The less time spent in hot water, the better. Then, he suggested that they wet towels with cold water from the sink of their cell and drape them on their neck and shoulders. Then, they should run in place on the cold cement floor with bare feet. He offered suggestions on how to create a wetsuit from materials that they had, and maybe the most valuable information he gave was about the tides. He said, quote, "Let the tide take you and move you toward the nearest land gradually. Don't panic. Distance looks greater when you're in water." End quote. According to Bulger, he also recommended making some sort of flotation device out of rubber gloves, as well as a bag to keep their shoes dry. If all that is true, it's possible that they may have been able to condition themselves to prepare for the cold water. Tidal experts say that there was a window of time on the night of the 11th that could have resulted in a successful escape. If the men had entered the water between 11 p.m. and midnight and paddled north toward Angel Island, the currents could have taken them to Horseshoe Bay rather than under the Golden Gate Bridge and out into the Pacific. So now we know that it's possible to swim from Alcatraz to the mainland, and we know that there's a small period of time that could have been used to their advantage. They may have been able to literally just go with the flow without exerting too much effort on their part if they had left at the right time. An argument that goes along with the theory that they made it on their own is that if they had paddled hard enough, they could have made it to Angel Island as planned. It would have taken a lot of time and energy, but if they had made their raft, oars, and life jackets well enough, who's to say that it couldn't be done? The next theory is not necessarily involving how they made it ashore, but what may have happened along the way. Some people think that the Anglins used Morris to plan the escape and then killed him once they got into the bay. A lot of the sightings after the escape were of John and Clarence, with no mention of Frank. About 8 months after the escape, a body was found on the shore of Point Reyes, which is about an hour north of San Francisco by car. It was determined that it was possible for the current to have carried a body from San Francisco to Point Reyes. The body that they found was highly decomposed and unidentifiable at that point. DNA technology didn't exist at the time, so pretty much all they could do was examine the body and take measurements. They determined that the person found was a male who was 5 feet and 7.5 inches tall, which just so happened to be the exact height of Frank Lee Morris. But because the body was so decomposed and they had no other means of identification, the man was buried under the name of John Bones Doe. In 2010, the U.S. Marshals Services were able to locate a distant paternal relative of Frank Lee Morris. The body was exhumed and the DNA was taken and compared against this distant relative. They hoped to get an answer for a long-awaited question. Was this Frank Morris? Will we actually know what happened to one of the men? Results came back, and there was no match. John Bones Doe was still unidentified, and we're no closer to solving the mystery. That doesn't dispel the theory, though. Remember the body that was sighted by the Norwegian freighter? Although it was never recovered, according to the description that was given, it's thought that that might have been the body of Frank Morris. I'm curious to know if the body sighted by the Norwegian freighter could be the same body as John Bones Doe, but again, there's no way of knowing. I also personally don't believe this theory because John and Clarence had committed their large bank heist using a fake plastic gun. It's said that they used the fake gun because they couldn't stand the thought of actually hurting someone. They were bank robbers, not murderers, but again, who knows? The next theory is that Morris and the Anglins had help from the outside. Many believe that a boat may have been waiting for them in the bay. No boats were allowed within 200 yards of Alcatraz, so it's thought that they may have paddled the 200 plus yards out into the bay where they hopped into a boat. Clarence Carnes, the inmate who received the gone fishing postcard, was well trusted by other inmates, so he was told a lot of secrets. Carnes told authorities that a boat had picked up the convicts in the bay and took them to Pier 13. It was rumored that another inmate named Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson had arranged for a boat to pick them up. Authorities thought that this information was false, and they didn't take Carnes seriously because of his criminal background. Arranging for a boat would have been extremely difficult from inside the prison and expensive. To alert someone on the outside that it was time for the escape probably wouldn't have been possible, and to put a boat in the bay every night on the off chance that it was finally time for the escape would have cost thousands of dollars. That was a resource that none of these men had. Alan West was questioned about receiving help from the outside, and he denied the existence of outside contacts. However, one police officer named Robert Checkey was off duty on the night of June 11th, and he recalls seeing a white boat in the bay with no lights on just before midnight. There was no noise coming from the boat, and he couldn't see anyone, but he could see a flashlight that was scanning the dark surrounding waters. When he learned of the escape the next morning, he immediately reported the boat. He was questioned by the FBI for days and claims to recall them saying something along the lines of, "Let's just make this go away, let's bury it." The last theory is one that was presented by an ex-con, drug runner, and friend of the Anglin brothers, Fred Breezy. Breezy grew up with the Anglins and knew their family well. He thought that the men may have used the raft to paddle around the island to the boat dock. There, they could have tied their raft to the rudder of a ferry that was going back to the mainland. It was scheduled to leave shortly after 12 a.m. that night, as it did every night. There's even a bit of evidence that might support this theory. An electrical cord was reported missing from the dock the night of the escape. Maybe that's what they used to tie their raft to the ferry. In part one, we talked about a Sports Illustrated magazine found in Morris's cell. This magazine mentioned how to pull a boat into a dock, how to tie a boat to a dock, and how to pull away from the dock. Maybe they used some of those methods for their raft. So let's say they made it. Where did they go? Well, in January of 1965, there was a rumor circulating that Clarence Anglin was living in Brazil. The FBI sent agents to investigate, but they didn't find anything. In 1967, an old classmate of Frank Morris called the FBI and reported that he had seen Frank in Maryland and that he now had a beard and mustache. He apparently refused to give any further details. Aside from these sightings, there was also a deathbed confession made by a man in 1993. He claimed that he had picked up the men from the bay and was paid to drive them to Seattle. Instead of taking them to Seattle, the man had decided that he was going to kill them and steal their money. The man claimed that the men were in the back of the van hiding when he got out of the vehicle, opened the doors, and started shooting. He said that he buried the men right there in a park on the outskirts of Seattle. This was all written down in an extremely detailed letter. Authorities were actually able to find the exact spot that the man claimed the men were buried, and they began digging, but no bodies were found. Let's backtrack a little bit. In 1979, 17 years after the escape, the FBI closed their investigation and turned the case over to the U.S. Marshal Services. According to U.S. Marshal Michael Dyke, none of the files had been computerized at that point, and it took 2 years to get all of the files from the FBI. Once the U.S. Marshal Services had the case in their hands, some interesting things were discovered, or uncovered, however you want to look at it. There are two extremely significant things that the FBI reports didn't quite cover. Apparently, a teletype was sent out on June 12, 1962, at 11:10 a.m. It contained a message that said, quote, "Raft believed to be used by escapees located on Angel Island," end quote. According to the FBI and what was shared with the public, the raft was never found. They mentioned finding the life vests and the oars, as well as the little bag that contained personal items, but supposedly, like the men, the raft was never found. So, maybe it was a mistake? Well, a day later on June 13th, a memo was sent out that said, quote, "According to information received by the Stanislaus County Sheriff's Office, a raft had been found on Angel Island, footprints were found leading away from the raft, and it was assumed that the escapees had come ashore at that point on Angel Island." End quote. What? Then, another bombshell was dropped. The memo said to be on the lookout for a 1955 Chevrolet, blue in color, bearing the California license plate KPB-076. This blue Chevy had been reported stolen in Marin County, exactly where West said that they were going to go. When the case was in the FBI's hands, there supposedly were no crimes after the escape. No stolen cars, no banks robbed, nothing. The FBI used that as a basis that the men had probably drowned. So what is this all about? The memo says the date and the time that the vehicle was stolen is unknown, but on June 12, 1962, at 11:30 a.m., California Highway Patrol received a call from a man in Stockton who said that he had been run off the road by three men in a 1955 blue Chevrolet. Maybe this is a crazy coincidence, but what are the odds? Later that same day, it was reported that three men were driving erratically in a 1955 blue Chevy. Over the next few months, reports involving a blue Chevrolet and matching the description of the escapees occurred in Oklahoma, Indiana, Ohio, and South Carolina. It appeared that if they did make it, they were traveling southeast. Morris was an orphan child who grew up in the prison system, but the Anglin brothers had family, friends, and connections in the southeast. It's possible that they would have places to go and people to cover for them. The majority of the Anglin brothers' family are firm believers that they made it out alive. Marie Anglin, their little sister, said that she had proof of their survival. Apparently, for the first 3 years after the escape, her family received a Christmas card in their mailbox. The cards had no return address, no postmark, and no stamps. The Anglin brothers' mother received a bouquet of flowers every year on her birthday until her death. The flowers had no card and no names attached, but she was convinced that they were from her sons. When Mrs. Anglin passed, there were reportedly two strange women in attendance at her funeral that the family believes were John and Clarence. Perhaps the most compelling evidence came from a photograph taken in 1975. Fred Breezy, the guy who theorized that they tied the raft to a ferry, met up with the family in 1992 and gave them a photograph that was taken in Brazil. In this photo, two men stood side by side, one blonde and one brunette. On Travel Channel's show Mission Declassified, the host Christoph Putzel speaks to Ken Widener, one of the Anglin brothers' nephews. Widener showed him this photo and said that it was a photograph of John and Clarence taken on their farm in Brazil, but wouldn't elaborate on any details. He also claimed that he had more photographs and more proof that they had survived, but instead of sharing any information, he said, quote, "If you think we're going to turn them in, you're sadly mistaken," end quote. He did reveal, however, that in letters and conversations with, quote-unquote, certain people, Morris had also survived and fled. He claimed to know where, but refused to say. If you want to watch the episode for yourself, it's Season 1, Episode 1. I really enjoyed it. In the episode, Christoph dives into the FBI files on the case, which you can find a link to on my website, mysticandmurder.com, and he conducts his own investigations and experiments to see if surviving the escape would even be possible. He also follows that lead from the photograph and goes to Brazil in an attempt to find the farm that the picture might have been taken on. And honestly, what he finds is pretty amazing. The final compelling thing that supports the theory that the men survived is a letter. The San Francisco Police Department received this letter at the Richmond Station in 2013. It read, quote, "My name is John Anglin. I escaped from Alcatraz in June 1962 with my brother Clarence and Frank Morris. I'm 83 years old and in bad shape. I have cancer. Yes, we all made it that night, but barely. Frank passed away in October 2005. His grave is in Alexandria under another name. My brother died in 2011. If you announce on TV that I will be promised to first go to jail for no more than a year and get medical attention, I will write back to let you know exactly where I am. This is no joke. This is for real and honest truth." End quote. The letter continues, and the handwriting is pretty hard to read, but it goes on to say that he had spent several years in North Dakota, but it was too cold. It then says that he spent most of his time in Seattle, Washington, but was now in Southern California. So, if they made it, maybe they hadn't been in Brazil after all. Or maybe John lied about their whereabouts in the letter. Or maybe it wasn't written by John England at all. The letter was analyzed for fingerprints and a match in handwriting, but just like the postcard back in 1962, it came back inconclusive. Instead of taking action and responding to the letter, nothing was done that we know of. The letter wasn't even made public until 5 years later in 2018. The family of the England brothers were upset by this, and they wished that they at least knew of the letter's existence. It's been 59 years since the escape, and today, Frank Lee Morris would be 95 years old, John England would be 91, and Clarence England would be 90 years old. The case will remain open with the U.S. Marshals Service until they're caught, their bodies are found, or until they turn 99 years old, meaning that this case will most likely stay open until 2030, when Clarence England would be the last one to age out. Before we go, I want to tell you about some of the resources I used for this case. I found them all really intriguing, and I thought that you might as well. One of the most interesting things I stumbled upon was a website called the England Brothers Museum. This is a site that was created by two of John and Clarence's nephews. There's a lot of pictures and unique things on there, so feel free to check it out. One of the books I read for this episode is called Alcatraz, A Definitive History of the Penitentiary Years by Michael Eslinger. Not only does it have a lot of information and detail about the 1962 escape, it also covers the 13 other escape attempts as well as an extremely broad history of Alcatraz, starting from the island's discovery. If you want to know more about the island, the prison, and the other escape attempts, definitely give it a try. On top of reading the book, I watched a lot of documentaries. Aside from the Mission Declassified episode that I told you about earlier, I watched episodes about the escape from Codes and Conspiracies, Unsolved Mysteries, Mythbusters, Mysteries at the Museum, Conspiracies Decoded, America Declassified, BuzzFeed Unsolved, and Mysteries of the Missing, to name a few. I also really enjoyed National Geographic's documentary on the case called Vanished from Alcatraz. Something else that I found really cool is that I was actually able to locate the specific issues of Popular Mechanics and Sports Illustrated that the England brothers and Morris probably used in the escape. These issues were digitized, and I'll put a link to them up on the episodes page of mysticandmurder.com. I'm really interested in knowing your thoughts on this escape, as well as the 1937 escape of Rowan Cole. Do you think that any of the men made it? If they did, how do you think they did it, and where do you think they went? Let me know. Comment on Instagram, tweet me, or send me an email and tell me your thoughts. Personally, I think they made it. I think they all made it to the mainland, and then Morris and the England brothers decided to go their separate ways, but there's a really good possibility that we'll never know. That's all for today's episode. New episodes of Mystic and Murder will be posted every other Sunday. Tune in, follow, and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and more. You can find the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at mysticandmurder.com. You can send in an email to mysticandmurder@gmail.com with suggestions, requests, and even personal spooky stories. If you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, you can go to www.patreon.com/mysticandmurder. You can click support at anchor.fm/mysticandmurder. You can make a donation at paypal.me/mysticandmurder. Or you can buy Mystic and Murder merchandise. Head to www.mysticandmurder.com/shop to learn more. Thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you sleep tight. Remember, all things weird lurk at night.